And that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses?
No, I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel, and I'm your host on today's program, Digital Radio. Now it's for real. On March 22nd, at a marathon open meeting, the FCC approved digital radio broadcasting and has turned it from an experimental service into a real one. Today we'll be exploring some of the pieces of that decision, and I'll be talking to Lee Robartis, who's the manager and news director at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, about what this means for independent community radio. Do stay tuned. Well, as I just mentioned in the intro, on March 22nd, the Federal Communications Commission held a marathon open meeting with a good 14 or 15 items on the agenda, going over simple things and bigger policy issues, such as the future of the internet, freedom on the internet, network neutrality, as well as rules now governing digital audio broadcasting, also known as digital radio, also known as HD radio, also known as IBOC radio. IBOC standing for its technical status of in-band on-channel, meaning you're broadcasting with a digital signal on the normal analog FM band or AM band. All five commissioners did vote in favor of solidifying these rules for digital audio broadcasting, although the two Democrats did dissent in areas in part to the rules adopted. The rules adopted on digital broadcasting included the ability for FM radio stations to operate in the extended hybrid digital mode, and the requirement, this is, I think, an important one, that each local station broadcasting in digital mode has to simulcast a digital signal of at least comparable audio quality to its analog signal. And the reason why that's important is because with digital radio, a broadcaster can split up its digital spectrum to actually have multiple channels. But the more you split it up, the more channels you try and cram in there, the lower the quality of each of those channels. The FCC is saying that your main primary digital channel has to have an audio quality as good as your main analog FM channel. Also, that channel has to have the same programming. So if someone upgrades to a digital radio to listen to their favorite stations in digital, they should get all the benefits of the digital broadcast as they've been advertised with the same program, and not at all deteriorated. The FCC adopted a flexible bandwidth policy permitting a radio station to transmit high-quality audio and multiple program streams and data casting services at its discretion. So the FCC is saying besides that main digital channel, there could be remaining digital bandwidth where they could do data services, or they could have other audio channels, which could be all talk, they could be music, and it's up to the station to set what they want to do. It also allows radio stations to time broker its unused digital bandwidth to third parties. That means they could sell off channels or broker time for other broadcasters or other organizations to use their audio channels, or they could broker it off to sell data services. Something that's been brought up is maybe some sort of internet service could be offered, or data service could be offered over those channels. The FCC also says that it applies existing programming and operational statutory and regulatory requirements to all free digital audio broadcasting programming streams. That just means that all the rules that apply to normal FM and AM apply to digital FM and AM. And this is one that's very controversial, which Lee will get into in a little bit when I talk to him, in that the FCC has authorized the use of digital audio broadcasting on AM stations at night. Up to this point, during the experimental phase, AM stations have only been able to broadcast with digital during the day. As anyone who's listened to AM, AM band at night, you realize that stations go much further, and often there's a lot of noise and there's a lot of interference. Critics of digital audio broadcasting say that on AM, the digital audio signal causes too much interference to be allowed to be broadcast at night. The FCC apparently disagrees. The FCC has also asked a couple of questions, so there is a further comment period being put out where they're asking for comments from both the industry and the public about the appropriate limits to the number of and the amount of subscription services that a radio station may offer using their digital spectrum, and also comments on whether the commission should adopt any new public interest requirements for digital audio broadcasters. So it's kind of a big day for radio, and one that you're not hearing quite so much about in the mainstream media. And to really get a little bit more about it, I think it's instructive to go and listen to the FCC commissioners themselves and hear their opinions on digital audio broadcasting. So first off, we're going to listen to the two Democrats on the commission. First, we'll hear from Michael Copps, and then we'll hear from Jonathan Adelstein talking about digital radio.
Digital radio means multiple audio programming channels, audio on demand services, and receivers that can pass along information ranging from song and artist identification to news and traffic and weather bulletins and public safety, all of it free of the static and hiss and pop that sometimes limit our analog system. Even as it begins to deliver all this to consumers, it's great good news for broadcasters too, because it provides exciting new business opportunities that just might reinvigorate free over-the-air radio. So there's a lot here to be happy about. Digital broadcasting has the power to reconfigure the communications landscape in good and powerful ways if we get our policies right. If we get our policies right, we can ensure that digital radio enhances localism and that it translates into more locally originated programming and public affairs coverage and airtime for local musicians and creative artists. If we get our policies right, we can ensure that digital radio enhances diversity through a wider range of programs, viewpoints, and new opportunities for underserved and non-English-speaking communities. If we get our policies right, we can give real meaning to public interest broadcasting in the digital age. Let's be clear, broadcasters today are able to multicast. But by adopting a blanket authorization for all digital radio, this decision virtually confers a free pass on everyone else to take their spectrum, bypass local communities, and run more of the canned nationalized programming that is all too common in our consolidated analog system today, and which, truth be told, is responsible for many of broadcast radio's current troubles. So I'm disappointed that we move ahead without actually answering important questions about how this spectrum that belongs to the people, will be used to benefit local communities.
Unfortunately, I can't fully support today's item because it's another missed opportunity for the commission to promote diversity and the public interest, another dream deferred. After years of ignoring the issue, punting the question, and delaying constructive dialogue to develop meaningful solutions, it's really disappointing that the commission has once again failed to step up to the plate. There's no justification for the commission's outright refusal to encourage digital audio broadcasters to enter into time brokerage agreements with women and minority broadcasters or new entrants. It's not asking a lot for us to simply encourage positive action, but apparently it was too much for a majority of the commission.
And that was Jonathan Adelstein, a Democratic commissioner on the Federal Communications Commission, and before him, Michael Copps, his fellow Democrat on the Federal Communications Commission. Next up, we're going to hear from the Republicans. We'll start off with Deborah Taylor Tate, followed up by Robert McDowell, and then finally, the chairman of the commission, Kevin Martin.
I'm pleased that in doing so, we allow the market to determine the pace of the transition and the stations to determine how to use their digital bandwidth. The flexibility to offer multicast programming of all kinds and enter into time brokerage agreements for digital bandwidth will unleash the creativity of the marketplace and hopefully provide even more opportunities to new entrants, something that we all support, resulting in improved radio services for all Americans. I too support seeking comment on public interest obligations, but feel it's premature to impose any new additional obligations at this stage of infancy.
Our action today also allows the U.S. to catch up to several other countries that have already adopted digital broadcast standards. I applaud the courageous early adopters of IBOC technology for taking the initiative and embracing the capabilities of digital radio and multicasting to provide their listeners with better quality sound and expanded programming options, particularly for underserved and niche audiences, without an additional government mandate to do so. Thank goodness the private sector did not wait for the government to act. The Commission has delayed adopting these standards for nearly a year while we debated whether to foist additional regulations on this budding and nascent technology.
And I think that in that process that it's critical for us not to lose sight of those public interest obligations that have traditionally applied, and I think that's why it's been so critical that we do and include the further notice. And I particularly appreciate my Republican colleagues' willingness to go along with the further notice of proposed rulemaking. I know some of them had concerns about that at this stage and wanted more time to see how the marketplace would develop, but I appreciate their willingness to do that. I do have to note that, and I don't mean to speak for the Republican colleagues, but I think that we're probably all we can't seem to catch a break on the first wireless item. I think that my Democratic colleagues said that they wanted to ask additional questions about net neutrality. And the net neutrality NOI, we asked additional questions, but then they said they wanted an NPRM. And on this item, we asked in the NPRM, but now they said that they want even further questions. We're going to pin you guys down yet. We're going to catch you yet on one of these items before the day's over.
And that was Chairman Kevin Martin of the FCC. At the end there, kind of sticking it a bit to his Democratic colleagues on the commission, a little bit of inside baseball there, but what essentially he's sticking them for is they're saying that they wish there had been more specific questions, which the commission is asking in its next phase of setting a few more rules for digital audio broadcasting. At the moment, the commission has really just said, what should we do with regard to public interest obligations? And the Democrats, Michael Copps and Jonathan Elstein, have said that they wish the questions were more specific so that they could get probably better and more specific answers, giving people some guidance as to what additional public interest standards might be. So sticking it to them a little bit. Before that was Art McDowell, who's one of the newest members of the FCC. And before that was Deborah Taylor Tate. All Republicans talking about digital audio broadcasting. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm Paul Reese-Mandel. I am your host. And you can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, the program, the radio program. You can download it at radio.mediageek.net, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. And the reason I'm talking about digital radio here today on the program is because I think it actually has a lot of potential impact on independent and grassroots media, as well as on the FM and AM dials altogether in ways that maybe you haven't heard about. You've probably heard about it if you've been listening to the program. John Anderson, a pal of mine who runs DIYmedia.net and is also the producer of Media Minutes for Free Press, has been on talking about his research into digital radio, and he's certainly been a critic of it. And to get a little bit perspective from grassroots radio, from community radio, I spoke with Lee Robartis. He is the manager and news director for KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, a station that also carries the Media Geek program. And I asked him to tell me more about why he's critical of digital radio.
So, Lee, you told the FCC when they were in Seattle, and actually wasn't the full FCC, right? It was just the Democratic commissioners.
Yes, Adelstein and Copps.
Adelstein and Copps. You gave them a piece of your mind about digital radio, also called IBOC, also sort of misleadingly called HD radio. What's your truck?
Well, one of the biggest problems with digital radio is, you know, I read this quote, good old FM radio isn't that bad. That's the problem for digital radio. And you know how when you use HD radio in a car, if you have one of those receivers, you hear the analog signal for a few seconds, and then it clicks over to the digital signal. So you can, well, hear the difference. Actually, in radio world, there was a editorial published about a month ago advocating dumbing down the analog FM signals to increase the wow factor. In other words, and also in AM, HD radio, technically they have to cut off the frequency response at 5K in order to prevent the analog signal from interfering with the HD radio or in-band on-channel, as they call it, IBOC sidebands. So that's part of the problem. The other problem is interference. It's expensive for a small community station to implement, and if you have a big station that converts to HD radio on an adjacent frequency, it's going to cut into your listening area because it puts essentially a buzz on the airwaves that's very difficult to listen to or listen to a weak signal through. From what I hear, it's a lot worse on AM. We actually heard an AM sideband locally, and it was going on two adjacent frequencies on either side.
And so one of the things that some of the FCC commissioners have mentioned in their enthusiasm for digital radio has been the fact that other nations, say Britain, have already established digital audio broadcast services. And so in a way, you know, this IBOC, as it's called, it's helping to catch the U.S. up in that field.
Well, Britain did it on a totally separate band, so there would be no interference with the existing analog. And you got to understand, there's 2 billion analog radios in the United States, and people can buy a halfway decent radio for $20 down at the store, whereas, switching to digital terrestrial radio is not only expensive for the stations, unaffordable for a small college or community station or a low-power FM, but it's expensive for the consumer. Radios are running, the cheapest ones, I guess on sale they've had them for $100, but generally $200 or $300 to implement. That would be all fine and dandy if it wasn't for the interference that they cause to regular community broadcasters like us.
And the interference comes from the fact that a digital station takes up a little bit more space on the dial than an analog station takes up. And that extra space is so they can put this extra digital information into the station's signal.
Yeah, there's redundant sidebands on either side, actually. So an FM station would take up three times the amount of space on the dial. And they're not only packing it with a digital version of the analog signal, but they also are putting other audio channels on there. And they're also, according to the FCC decision yesterday, they also can have four-fee data services as well. So they're blocking you with things that you may not even have access to unless you can pay a fee for. And, of course, one of the big promoting points of digital radio is that these stations, hey, they can broadcast a second signal on their digital sideband. So not only get the regular station in digital mode, but you get another station that they might create. Well, the big problem, of course, with radio these days and declining in listenership with terrestrial radio is programming. You got to wonder if a lot of these HD2 or sideband radio signals are basically going to be automation. And when it comes to a media ownership point of view, well, it's just, Clear Channel's going to own those sideband signals or NPR or whatever. So you get the same corporate ownership getting twice or maybe three times as many signals in a market. So they'll go, from Clear Channel owning 8 signals in one market to Clear Channel owning between 16 and 24 in one market. And meanwhile, the small community station can't afford to convert, which, it's $75,000 at the absolute cheapest. And so they're going to still have one signal, and it may be, they may have less range for that signal.
One of the interesting things I thought from listening to the FCC commissioners give their statements on approving digital radio was Robert McDowell mentioned, this is great. We'll get lots of diversity on the airwaves because you'll get all these extra channels. And the only stations he mentioned as offering more diversity were public stations to begin with. mostly NPR stations, and only sort of express, and we hope that the commercial stations will do something similar. And then both the Democratic commissioners complained that, although they did both approve in part of the of digital radio, that there were no provisions to create new public service requirements for these extra channels.
Right. Well, you don't get diversity of ownership. And, you know, it's sort of the same conundrum as with the satellite radio systems, in that all those diverse channels are owned by the same corporation. So, yeah, they may have reggae, they may have bluegrass, they may have world music, they may have hip hop, you know, all those formats that can't, you know, that don't normally fit very well into AM and FM terrestrial radio. But they're going to be the gatekeepers of the playlist, and you probably aren't going to hear the social consciousness lyrics and the radical stuff that people are used to on or like to hear on community radio or college radio.
Well, let's take up the question of the small community stations. I mean, you'd think, you know, because IBOC HD Radio offers the ability to have these extra side channels, that there would be an opportunity for a community station to really offer more service to a community by having, you know, so one station could have an all talk channel and all music channel in addition to its main FM frequency. So you'd think that this could also be a boon for community radio stations like KRFP.
Well, we run a station on a few thousand dollars a year, and we're talking, the cheapest conversion to HD radio I've heard of is $75,000, plus commercial stations. I don't know if they've waived it for non-commercial stations, but you also have to pay Ubiquiti for the right to broadcast in their particular codec, which they own proprietary rights to. You'd also have to buy, you know, a new transmitter, new antenna, new studio to transmitter link, usually new studio equipment. You can't broadcast MP3s like we broadcast a lot of without seriously degrading the sound quality, because you're sending the audio through two separate codecs, which compounds digital hash that you might hear. So it's not really a viable thing for a small broadcaster. I volunteered in the past at a college station that at the time, a few years ago, operated on $5,000 a year. You know, they aren't going to be able to afford to upgrade, but they will have to take the interference if there's a station on an adjacent frequency broadcasting it.
And so, I mean, once again, with the way we're discussing it, it just sounds again like another land grab. You know, this is an opportunity to cram more services into the FM dial with
corporate
some trade-offs.
Services.
Yeah, corporate services. Mostly for the standpoint of commercializing them, and with barely a wink or a nod towards notions of public service or public accountability.
Yes, from what I understand, there will be no new public service obligations for the extra channels that might be available for the big corporate broadcasters. And I would think that would be a great opportunity to allow more, community or, I don't know, public service broadcasting, maybe produced by groups that are not affiliated with the corporate broadcaster. The FCC could require that. They have in the past, you know, before deregulation in the Reagan era, radio stations were required to put aside a certain amount of their broadcast time for public service programming, you know, whether they had a music format or not. You know, they had to do it. They usually put it on Sunday mornings, but
they did it. They did do it. And then what's left then is the FCC has two questions out in which it's seeking comment on. The first is it's looking for comments on the appropriate limits to the amount of subscription services that may be offered by radio stations, and that's on their digital side channels. And the FCC is also seeking comment on whether the commission should adopt any new public interest requirements for digital audio broadcasters.
Okay, so that's still out in the well. That's good. People should comment on that.
Yeah, and that is one opportunity, is to write into the FCC. Again, looking at the commission's makeup right now, with your three Republicans and two Democrats, you have almost a Republican swing vote going on with Robert McDowell, although he generally seems to still swing on the side of fewer, you know, restrictions or fewer requirements rather than more. And we can certainly count on Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein, the two Democrats, to push for public interest requirements. But whether or not that gets written in, whether or not this, you know, this may just be this might be lip service by the commission saying, well, listen, but whether it'll actually happen is another question.
Yeah, that happens all too often, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Well, Lee, thanks a lot for giving us a little bit more perspective on digital radio, IBOC radio. And, of course, I hope you don't see too much or any interference here at KRFP 90.3.
Yeah, I think the big problem is going to be in urban areas.
Yeah.
You know, closer to the cities and some of the, you know, outlying areas near big cities.
Well, great. Thanks again.
Okay, no problem.
And that was Lee Robartis. He is manager and news director for KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, a low-power community station and a station that carries the Media Geek program. Lee's also been a frequent contributor in the past to Free Speech Radio News, all about digital radio. And we'll get updated with more of what the FCC did, because there was a lot of stuff that can't fit all into today's show on the next edition of Media Geek. Before I wrap up here, I just want to make a quick mention of something that things are moving forward with regard to the new rates that the Recording Industry Association of America got implemented by the Copyright Review Board that I mentioned last week, that are greatly and stiffly increasing the amount of royalties that web radio broadcasters are going to be expected to pay the recording industry. NPR is getting into the mix, National Public Radio, on behalf of public radio stations and non-commercial stations, is filing to appeal the overall decision by the copyright judges to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit in Washington. It's appealing both the increase in rates and also the $500 per channel minimum fee that is supposed to be charged to online stations by the Recording Industry of America. Of course, community stations like WEFT, the home station for Media Geek, we're watching it with great care, because it does really impact a station. If there were enough listeners, it could be possible that very large fees would be incurred by stations in a way that we otherwise don't have to pay for our on-air feed. And of course, a lot of small webcasters and medium-sized commercial webcasters are also very worried that they may be put out of business too. So the fight is not over yet, and I will say I'm glad to see NPR pick it up and take this to court, because it really does seem like a very boneheaded move on the part of the recording industry to mostly stamp out non-commercial internet broadcasting. But then again, it's a group known to be very good at biting the hand that feeds it.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm host and producer Paul Riesmandel. I'll be back in 1 week with another half-hour look at independent and grassroots media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. In the meantime, check out the frequently updated Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. The program can also be downloaded at Radio.MediaGeek.net, where you can subscribe to the podcast. Media Geek is produced at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and is heard on 10 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WYQZ in Warrenton, Bealeton, Virginia, KWMD Kosilov in Anchorage, Alaska, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. It's also on the web at Free Radio San Diego, Pirate 969.org, and radiodriftless.org. Media Geek is free to air on your local non-commercial station too. Just email Paul at MediaGeek.net. That's also where you can send comments about the program, Paul at MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.